from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Last summer, researchers started noticing large numbers of starfish dying off along the Pacific coast. So far, nobody knows exactly what is causing this syndrome, known as sea star wasting disease, which causes skin lesions that decay and turn the starfish into what has been described as goo. And we want to talk to some of the scientists who are trying to get to the bottom of the starfish die-off. Joining us is Pete Raimondi. He's chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
I also say good morning to Benjamin Miner, who is with us by phone this morning as well from up in Western Washington. He's professor of marine biology at Western Washington University. Welcome, Benjamin Miner.
Hi, welcome.
Glad to have you both. And let me begin, if I might, Professor Raimondi, with you, just so listeners know what we're talking about with respect to this wasting syndrome. It's pretty gruesome, the arms, and a lot of people think starfish will grow back arms, but the arms begin to create lesions and fall off, and before you know it, as I said, they've turned into goo. And are we talking about possibly millions of these?
Well, we don't know how many. We think it could be as high as that. As you might imagine, it's difficult to survey sea stars in a general sense because most of them are underwater, and we have limited access in a lot of locations. But when we do our projections and when we consider all the species that seem to be affected at this point, that's not an unreasonable number.
And large numbers are dying off, we know, in individual tide pools, right?
Yeah, there's really two systems that we've been working in. One is these what we call tide pool systems, and the other is subtidal areas, those that are underwater. There's really only one or two species that are affected in tide pool areas, and in some locations they're very severely affected. But that's where most people encounter sea stars, is in tide pools. I have to say that probably the subtidal systems are even more affected. In fact, today we got a report from a fisher who was fishing about 5 miles off of San Francisco and said that he's starting to see diseased and decaying sea stars way offshore. So that was brand new news to us.
Well, let's talk about the effect of this, and let me go to you, Benjamin Miner, on this. The mussel population I've been reading will expand tremendously with starfish, or as they're called, sea stars, decreasing, and also sea stars, or sea, I'm used to calling them starfish, they keep sea urchins in check, and sea urchins gnaw at kelp plants from the top to the bottom, so it's kind of like clear-cutting the forest almost. It has an ecological effect that's pretty widespread.
The sea stars, the different species will eat different prey. As Pete was referring to, the sea stars that are in the intertidal commonly will eat mussels, and they can, because they're oftentimes in very high density, they can have a significant impact on the mussel populations there. Subtidally, the species, certain species eat different type of prey. For this example up here, there's one species of sea star that eats another species of sea star. And then one of the species that's rather severely affected in the subtidal population, which it's called Pycnopodes helianthoides, also known as the sunflower star. It's known as kind of a voracious predator within those habitats, and it will eat a number of things, clams, mussels, other sea stars, crabs, just about anything that it comes across. And so certainly in those areas, the species, when it disappears, that it normally eats, obviously do better.
Yeah, they're major predators in the sense you're describing. So we're talking about something that could have an effect on the whole ecosystem, or certainly balancing the ecosystem along the North American coasts. But maybe the ecosystem is what's causing the unhealth? I guess what I want to get at here is what's behind this. There's been supposition that maybe it's bacteria, or it's viruses, or it's just the environment itself.
Yeah, I would say that at this point, it's not clear exactly the cause of it. I would say that all of those things may contribute to what we're seeing, and that's probably the reason why it's been difficult to figure out exactly what's happening. The patterns that we see make it especially kind of perplexing, because we've seen major die-offs in regions that are geographically separated. For example, Santa Barbara, Monterey, the C- Seattle area, and then up in British Columbia and in the Vancouver area. So, and then areas in between those appear in some places quite healthy, where we're not seeing, you know, major die-off. So, so kind of the locations, and then in addition to the fact that it's affecting many species, some of them rather distantly related among sea stars, makes it really challenging.
It can move between species, right?
It appears to be that way. Certainly when areas are affected, we see multiple species dying in those areas. And obviously, the obvious conclusion is that it's spread among those individuals.
But back in the early 80s, I know there was almost a wipeout, certainly a big die-out of this number of species of sea star starfish over on the coast of Southern California, and they came back. And there's at least some hypothesizing that even though this didn't happen in warm water, as was the cause with El Nino and the cause in the past, that they will come back?
You want me to take this? This is Pete.
Yeah, go ahead, Pete Ramone.
Sure. Yeah, there's been at least three major die-offs that have occurred prior to this. One was in the late 70s. One was in 83, 84, and one was in 97, 98. In all those cases, it was associated with warm water. And to be honest, at the time, we thought that it was probably due to warm water, although at this point, we think that that may be the reason, but it also might be that that warm water, which was southerly water that came north, might have carried with it a pathogen that caused there to be the syndrome then, too.
Well, forgive me, Pete, but bacteria does divide quicker in warm water, yeah?
That's right. That's exactly right. And it could have been a local species, too, of bacteria or whatever that went rogue, essentially, during those warm water events. You know, what has been noted, we've got this perplexing geography because it doesn't appear that there is a warm water event, at least a general warm water event, that led to this particular outbreak. But getting back to the original question, they went away, but they were the area that was affected was pretty limited. It was limited to Southern California and Mexico, and then they took a while, but they did come back. They especially took a while after the 83-84 El Nino, but they did come back, and I don't think anyone at this point is thinking that this system is not going to recover as well. These species generally, not all, but most of these species have very long-lived, very long-distance larvae, meaning that the babies can go to repopulate other areas. And so as long as we have patches, as been noted, that are apparently unaffected, those are the populations that may act to rebuild the stocks along the West Coast. I just want to give one cautionary note, though. The late 70s event, which was much more severe in Mexico and the Gulf of California, led to the virtual extinction of a species down in the Gulf of California, and it has still not recovered. So it's not extinct, but it has still not recovered. So these things can last a long time if the destruction is sort of throughout the range of the species.
And again, Pete Ramondi is chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at UC Santa Cruz. Benjamin Miner is professor of marine biology at Western Washington University. Professor Miner, we're also, I was looking at the fact that coast sardine harvests are down by about two-thirds. Is there a relationship between these?
I would say that the relationships that we see currently are just correlations in time among a number of things. There's been some other diseases that are reported in other species, and I would say at this point the only evidence that, you know, that the syndrome's linked with anything else that's happening in the environment is just the correlation in time. And so from my perspective, at least, that's relatively weak evidence that there's any tight link between those events.
But this is happening on the East Coast as well, and so, I mean, possibly for different causes entirely.
It does. So we've seen the what appear to be similar symptoms occurring on species in the East Coast. This was a couple years back that that a relatively localized die-off was documented on the East Coast. And so it's certainly possible that it's related in some way. But again, the separation makes it difficult to understand exactly, you know, how the disease may have gotten, you know, between the different locations.
Let me take this opportunity to bring our listeners into this, talking about the fact that last summer researchers started noticing large numbers of starfish or sea stars dying off along the Pacific coast, and so far nobody really knows exactly what's causing this syndrome, which is known as sea star wasting disease, and we're talking to some of the scientists who are trying to get to the bottom of this starfish diet. You can join us if you have questions or comments. We invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome you to the program, and you can join us by phone, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our website and post any questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Pete Raimondi, could the culprit in all this be ocean acidification?
It's probably not ocean acidification in a general sense. You know, what we've seen with respect to ocean acidification is that there are local areas which can be affected, but we don't see a broad, you know, any sort of broad pattern of it. And so we don't think it's due to ocean acidification. We also don't think it's due to some other kind of more local events, hypoxic events, which have been the culprit in other die-offs, but they've been very localized. We think it's got to be something that can has the ability to spread in a patchy fashion, and that's one of the reasons why we are sort of leading ourselves to the understanding that it may be a pathogen of some sort that then is distributed through ocean currents and other sort of oceanographic forcing.
Well, one of our listeners says, what about fallout from the earthquake tsunami, or Fukushima for that matter? Any chance the starfish have been affected?
Yeah, again, we really don't think that that's likely if you're speaking directly of the radiation for a couple of reasons. One is that the trajectories that have been proposed with respect to the distribution of any of the debris really don't come very far south and wouldn't have arrived here yet with respect to the radiation, but also just the distribution of the disease and the apparent lack of the disease in other areas really doesn't lend itself to that explanation.
You are looking for data here, and I want to make that clear to listeners because I'm even getting a listener tweet here that says, on my recent Monterey dive, most giant sea stars look healthy with a few wasted stars. Looking for data, if people are going out there like this listener just tweeted on a dive or are just going to the beach or whatever, how can they get that data to you?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. We have a web page. Both Ben and I are work on this web page, and it's called seastarwasting.org. So it's pretty easy. In fact, if you just type in sea star wasting, that's the first page you'll get to on a Google search. And there's a whole bunch of information for your listeners on that, including a recent map. We update the map once or twice a month, which shows the locations and the species where the disease has been found. But there's also a link for observations that people might make. And that really is helpful because one of the key components to try to understand how this disease is progressing and what might be one of the reasons for the disease is this epidemiological map, which we're hoping will allow us to figure out how many points of initiation there were and what the direction and rate of the spread is. And listeners or observers out in the field can really help in that endeavor.
Again, Benjamin Miner, 5 years ago there was devastation, about 90% of starfish died and, again, bounced back. Could this be some kind of natural occurrence? Is that possible?
It certainly is. In fact, I would say that's the most likely explanation that we have so far. We've seen events that appear to be very, very similar to what we're seeing this time, though more localized. And as a result, I would say that most of the research that are investigating the disease right now believe that it's probably something that has been occurring in the past, and for some reasons that were not clear yet, we've had just an expansion of the disease and many, many more individuals affected by that.
But the biggest mystery is, as we've said, in the past it's been linked more to warm water, and this is a cold water species.
Yeah. That's true. One of the possibilities that could, a possible explanation is that as the disease is kind of, it appears to be moving more northward, at least along the west coast, it will move in and contact new species that don't, that the ranges don't exist down in Southern California, for example. And so if those species are potentially more susceptible and then can spread more rapidly to disease, you might get kind of this wildfire effect that occurs as soon as it moves into the zone of these new species.
You got about how many different species, like 1,900 or so?
Well, in the area, is within the Puget Sound area, Washington, in inner waters, the diversity of sea stars is relatively high for any particular area. There's in the 20s different species of sea stars, and that's much greater than most other areas.
But overall, we're talking about hundreds of,
in fact, there's probably several thousand different species of sea stars.
Well, let me bring our callers on. We bring John on first as... caller from Tiburon. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to say thank you very much for your show that you're having this morning, because it answered, or it's answering, a big question that I had. I'm an abalone diver on the North Coast here in California. And most recently, last week, I was out in the snorkeling in the Monterey Bay with my 9-year-old daughter. And even though we see a definite and general degradation of the ocean every year when we go out, this year it was very clear that the sea stars were shockingly affected. We were wondering where they all were. And even we have found some of those gloopy masses out there in even a sort of transitional phase where you see the stars losing all of their color and kind of turning white. They look kind of like ghost sea stars. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you for clearing up that question that we had about what in the world was going on.
Well, thank you, John. And it's interesting because that tweet came in from another diver in Monterey who said he hadn't seen that much wasting. But it's pretty evident because, Pete Raimondi, I mean, like I said, the arms fall off and they just kind of disintegrate into goo.
Yeah, and underwater especially, it can be pretty rapid. I think one of your callers or a tweet that you got said that they hadn't seen much of an effect with what they called the giant sea star. And there is a species here which we call the giant sea star, and it has been one of the more resistant species to it. What's very interesting is if you've been diving, what you'll see is a change in the species that you see. You won't see the giant sea stars, as Ben was talking about. I mean, you won't see the Pycnopodia, which is the sunflower star. Those have pretty much disappeared. There's a number of other species that have disappeared, and in place of them, what you see in many places in the Monterey and Santa Barbara area are what we call bat stars. Bat stars are pretty common, and they seem not to be very affected by the disease.
Yeah, so, I've got an email here from somebody says, Robert says, diving Monterey, I've seen almost no sun stars or giant spine stars, but bat stars seem to be doing well, and wants to know what's behind that or what's the rationale.
Well, one of the things, we've been diving a lot here, and one of the things that happened, which is really interesting, is as these other stars were dying, bat stars are a different type of star, and they eat, you know, detritus, meaning dead things, and so they swarm to the dying sea stars, and they're doing great down here.
They're feasting, huh?
They're feasting, yeah. And they're also very apparent because they're swarming in mass to these dying things, and so you tend to see a lot of them right now.
Here's TJ, our next caller. Good morning, TJ.
And I'm a marine biology graduate student at San Francisco State University, and I study mainly climate change stress on invertebrates in the intertidal zone. So I'm super interested, because I study mainly larvae, if the larvae of the sea stars are potentially being affected by the disease, and if there's been any studies to see if the larvae have any type of inheritance of the disease from the sea stars and how climate change could possibly exacerbate that, and I could take my response offline if that's okay.
All right, that's fine, and thank you for the questions. Actually, two questions, Benjamin Miner, about larvae and about climate change.
So the one of the things that appears to be the case is that at many of the sites where we see the die-offs, there's juveniles that are healthy of these particular species, and so one of the things that's very curious is oftentimes, the younger individuals within populations are more susceptible to certain diseases, but in this case, it appears that they're more resistant. That, to me at least, suggests that it's likely not that the larvae are contracting the disease, bringing it in, though it certainly is possible that they're housing that pathogen, and then as they become later in life, for some reason, they become more susceptible, though it's kind of hard to envision exactly the mechanism that would allow them not to be affected early, but later in life. The different species that have different types of larvae, for example, the life histories are different among some of these species. One of the species that has been reported to be affected is Leptosterius. It's a six-rayed sea star, and it actually doesn't have any larvae. The juveniles are held by the adult, and they just crawl away, and that species is affected. So that would suggest, at least, that it's probably not something that's occurring as a result of the larvae and then being passed on to later life history stages.
And what about climate change in all this, Professor Miner or Professor Amundi? You want to speculate?
Well, I would say that in any case, one of the issues that's very difficult to kind of pinpoint exactly what's happening is the fact that you can have direct causes of the disease, but then you can obviously have lots of indirect causes that exacerbate it. So, for example, you might have the fact that some type of pathogen is being spread among individuals, overwhelming their immune system, but environmental factors that are suppressing the immune system can obviously exacerbate the issue. And so though you may figure out that, oh, this is the thing that's being transferred from individual to individual and making them sick, that doesn't necessarily rule out the possibility that these other environmental forcing factors like climate change might be making those individuals more susceptible in the first place.
I have a pedantic question, by the way, just a kind of sidebar pedantic question that maybe either of you can answer. I know they're not called starfish anymore. They're called sea stars because they're not fish to begin with. But when I studied Linnaeus, we learned that they were echinodermatids, and now they're just called echinoderms. Does anybody know why that is? They took off the ata?
Well, when biologists refer to the phylum that they're in, they
yeah.
are referred to as echinodermata. That's the Latin derivative of the phylum. When you just use kind of a casual term among biologists, we'll just call them echinoderms.
Okay. I got you. Thank you for that.
No
minor point. Let me get Taylor on as our next caller. Taylor, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We may have partially answered this, be it an exacerbating factor as opposed to the cause, but climate change, has anyone taken a map of ocean topography and laid it over the most heavy-hit areas, maybe to suggest they're shallower, or in our drought that we've had in California, the ocean temperature in those places has heated up a little bit with a little bit of extra sun, and, you know, could climate change be a factor that way? And secondly, kind of the other direction, I know we've talked about pollution. I'm looking at your Scientific American article here. Could it be the Texas-sized piece of plastic we've got slowly dissolving in the ocean? That's it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Pete Ramondi.
Yeah, I want to comment on a couple of things with respect to this question. The first is, what we have is a map that is pretty much driven by opportunity. And so what you'll see if you look at our map is the initial locations where we found it were close to population centers. That could be due to two things. It could be due to some aspect of pollution or discharge, but it also could be due to the fact that that's where most people are and that's where they're mostly looking. And so one of the key things to do is to try and figure out whether these observations are in some ways biased by where we've been looking, and that's why we're really hoping that we get these additional observations in more remote locations. The second thing is that we along the West Coast have been in a period of pretty cool weather. I mean, talking about oceanographic weather for about 15 years, since the 97-98 El Nino. So it has been cool. The water's been cool. There may be local warming areas, but in general, it's been a cool phase. And so it doesn't appear that this is related to any general sort of climate-related warming. That doesn't mean it couldn't be some sort of climate change aspect, like current changes where currents may be moving in different directions. But with respect to the general predictions with regard to climate change, meaning warming, we just aren't in a very warm period right now. Having said all that, drought could affect it because of the lack of discharge, or the discharge that does occur during the flushes might be sweeping down things that could be problematic. But one of the things to keep in mind is this is across a huge extent of coastline. We've seen the disease from Alaska down to San Diego, and it's probably in Mexico, although we have no good reports from there. And so we're looking for things that could be present or could be driving this in all of those locations, and that's a pretty limited set of things.
Well, John writes in an email, Elizabeth Colbert talked about Earth's sixth mass extinction on the show a couple weeks ago. This seems to be an example of how this can happen. And Matt writes, they're eating bivalves and filter feeders. Any chance of a correlation? Benjamin Miner?
Yeah, and I'll make one point that, that Pete brought up, too, is that because we see the disease popping up in those areas, the first thing that we look for is some single explanation that might explain what's happening among all of these different...
But there may be many causes, right?
Exactly. And so you could possibly have the situation that's very difficult to detect, that in different locations, the things that's stressing individuals out are different factors. And so, and again, that makes it exceedingly difficult to really pinpoint exactly the cause. Now, as far as the bivalves, it certainly is possible that, that filter feeders are concentrating some particular pathogen and then transferring it to the sea stars, and that's certainly something that we're pursuing right now.
And what about all that plastic, Pete Raimondi?
Well, again, you know, we're talking about areas that are, in completely pristine areas down to very degraded areas, and we don't see any pattern that is suggestive of that, you know. And again, there may be, as been noted, there may be local areas where plastics could be the form of the stress that allows them to be susceptible, and maybe localized warm water in another place and localized hypoxia in another place. But there's got to be some common vector that causes, under stress, these guys to become diseased. And again, that's what we're looking for. I don't think that plastic would be a general explanation for this.
Here's Val from Berkeley. Val, join us here on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I've been very interested in this research, and I'm a statistician. I'd like to see them do a population study that would be a random sample of the entire coastline, not just opportunity data, but looking at the, is there an urban effect? Is the human population coming into play here?
Yeah, I'll comment on that, and then Ben can add it if he wants to. That's exactly what we're doing now. So we've recently got funding both up in Washington and Ben's group and our group down here.
Well, excuse me, you got $50,000 to study this from for the California State Universities, right?
Well, no, it's from the Ocean Science Trust, which is different from that. But we did get that money.
But it's to the California State Universities. I just want to get that on the record, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's where the money is going for the research, yes?
It's going to the University of California system,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh, right.
Yeah. And it is exactly to do that, to fill in some of these areas where there's not opportunity observations so that we can make the mapping as unbiased as possible.
Yeah, and one of the things that also is challenging about the particular patterns that you see, that there's a lot of correlated effects. So where people settle oftentimes have related geography and patterns that lead to particular oceanographic characteristics in those areas. And so those correlations certainly are very informative initially, but again, they don't necessarily pinpoint exactly what's happening.
See anything? We really don't have time for another caller, but one caller's want to ask about, do you see any of this in the aquarium in Monterey?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the early phenomena that we noticed, was that with the first observations in many cases were in aquaria. And that's up and down the coast. That might be opportunity, but there might be something related to that.
Pete Raimondi, Benjamin Miner, continue your good work, and thank you for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Mark. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.